Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Owl Post is freshly delivered again this week, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, the one and only Drea Kaufman.
Hello!
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am doing well. I'm excited to be here because I feel like this is a pretty fun chapter to talk about for Slughorn. So, yeah, we've got chapter 4 we're going to be diving into. And before we do that, make sure that you check us out wherever you get your podcasts. But if you happen to be on Apple Podcasts, please do give us a star rating and review and help people find the show. Because, well, if you like Harry Potter podcasts, there are a lot of them out there. So if you want people to find us because you like us, help us out with those ratings and reviews. You can also find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. Please do follow us there. You can get all of your Owl Post news as well as everything else that's going on with the network, as well as on Facebook at facebook.com/thenerdparty. Please do like us. Also, both of those places are great places to interact with Drea and I, especially about Owl Post. We post the show in both places, so please let us know what you're thinking about each episode. We love having conversations with people. And if you would like to leave us an email, you can do that over on thenerdparty.com. Go to that contact section and choose Outpost, and then that email will come to Drea and I. So, Drea, I thought that something that was really funny about the very beginning of this chapter is the fact that Harry, inside his mind, is thinking, well, this is kind of awkward, hanging out with Dumbledore outside of school.
It is. It's very funny. He's very astute in his observations, how he has sort of always wanted that. And now that he has it, it's like, okay, this is a little weirder than I thought it was going to be.
Well, and it, like, I love the way that he thinks about it in his brain. He's like, well, but there was always like a desk between us. There was always this formality in our conversation, really, because it was teacher and student. And this feels a little bit more casual. And I mean, the last time we talked, I did smash up a lot of his possessions, so that's awkward.
Yeah, but clearly in these circumstances, he's sort of the only one that's uncomfortable. Dumbledore doesn't seem, as we expect, doesn't seem fazed at all by anything. So it's really fascinating. I do find it interesting, too, that Dumbledore, you know, goes to send Harry's bags off to the Burrow because they're going to take a sort of a side trip on their way. But in the process, he says, you know, Harry, take your invisibility cloak out. And I love that Harry's like, yes. And he kind of does it in this way, like a woman, like a mom going into her purse full of stuff. You like kind of hide how messy everything is. You're like, oh, yes, here's the one thing I needed. Don't mind the 8 tissues, 3 tampons and all of the receipts that came out with it. But here's my invisibility cloak that you're looking for. You know, that's kind of how Harry acts when he digs it out of this trunk, is like, please don't see how much of a total disaster my trunk is.
Well, and on top of that protection of the invisibility cloak, Dumbledore also gives him the ability to use his wand if needed. He says, keep your wand out, and if we're attacked, you are free to use any counter curse or any counter jinx, or you know, any jinx that you can think of. But I don't think we're going to be attacked tonight. And I love that Harry's like, but why? And Dumbledore just is so nonchalantly like, because you're with me.
I do love that. I do love the, like, he's kind of like confidence goals right there, right? Like, this, the owning of the fact that no one's going to attack them because, you know, Harry's with Dumbledore. There's nothing to worry about. That is such a, and it doesn't come off as like overly egotistical. It's just, he's very factual. This is why we're good to go. Are you ready? Are you ready?
Well, and this is interesting too, because this is where they apparate for the first time, for at least for Harry, this is the first time he's apparated because he's not allowed to yet. He hasn't taken the test. He has to be 17 to be able to do that. It's so interesting for him to experience that sensation. And when they land, they kind of continue on their conversation. And I thought it was really interesting because one of the first things that he asks him is about his scar, whether or not it's been hurting. And Harry's kind of surprised that it hasn't been, but I love the fact that Dumbledore has an explanation for why he is not.
Yeah, it's interesting because it also tells us that it kind of confirms all of the little cutaways we've been reading that Harry's been going through, and that, you know, Voldemort wasn't really blocking Harry out, wasn't really aware of that connection. In the last book, when he did get to be aware of it, he capitalized on it and manipulated Harry with it. And now we're to the point where, like, that's not worth it anymore to Voldemort. And he's just completely shut Harry out. And so the scar tingling, that's not something we should expect to be a thing going forward now.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting because what we see is that Voldemort has realized the danger of you know, letting Harry in, and you know, now he's definitely employing occlumency to make sure that Harry cannot get in with this connection that they have. And I love that
it also tells me a little bit that he's a little bit afraid of Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, you know, it does kind of give him a little bit of power in the situation, that not only did it give him a kind of one up in the past, but now the other party also acknowledges that it's a vulnerability, and that he should be afraid of Harry having that power, which is a big deal in this tiny little, like, just little nugget that we got here.
Well, and when you think about that too, the last time he was inside Harry's mind did not go well for him.
It's true. That's definitely true.
I love that Harry also is like, why are we walking around this random British village, basically? Like, why are we here? And this is where, you know, Dumbledore lays out the fact that they're here because they are short on teachers at Hogwarts this year again, and they're hoping, or Dumbledore's hoping, that they can recruit a member to come out of retirement and return to Hogwarts. And I love how Harry's like, but why am I here? And Dumbledore just kind of vaguely like, I think we'll find a use for you.
Well, and then I also love, we kind of go into this whole story about, well, why didn't we just, you know, why didn't we just apparate into the house? Like, why do we have to walk through the town? Like, why didn't we just go to exactly where we were going? Which ties back into the fact that a lot of, you know, advanced witches and wizards will protect their houses against that, much like Hogwarts is protected against apparition within its grounds. And I love, we get a little call out to Hermione here, where, you know, he's like, oh, like what Hermione said about, you know, Hogwarts. And Dumbledore's like, well, yeah, she is very correct. And it's just like a little nod back to a character we haven't seen for like four chapters now. You know, a reminder of that kind of context of it. Because if I remember correctly, that's from, I don't even know, that wasn't last chapter. It was that the third book that we last talked about not apparating within Hogwarts?
Oh, gosh.
It's been a while.
I feel like Hermione mentions it once each book. Someone says something, and she's like, well, nobody reads Hogwarts of History. But yeah, no, I mean, it. You're absolutely right. It is kind of a fun callback, because we got to the callback, you know, last chapter, the fact that Harry's going to be going to the Murrow. So, you know, and we're slowly getting these pieces of you know, where things have been, where these other characters have been, as we've been waiting to kind of get to the main part of our story with Harry. And I love, too, that we call back to the Daily Prophet that was on, you know, the floor of Harry's room.
Oh, yeah.
And they start talking about the idea that, you know, Scrimgeour has become the new Minister for Magic. And you can see Harry here trying to pry out of Dumbledore maybe not so subtly, about what he thinks about, you know, the new Minister for Magic, kind of see where their, you know, disagreement has come from. And I really love that Dumbledore is very diplomatic about it, and he does compliment Scrimgeour, but he does not go into at all what it is their disagreement was about.
Yeah, he doesn't bite on Harry's want for this essentially gossip, right? He doesn't feed into that at all. I do love that he kind of leads him there, because he also brings up the pamphlet we talked about in the last episode of you know, helpful safety tips for witches and wizards or whatnot. And he goes, well, then I assume, Harry, you also got that. And he goes, yeah, did you get one? And Dumbledore's like, yeah. And he's like, he asks Harry, Dumbledore asks Harry if he found it particularly useful. And he's like, no, not really. No, but Harry did bring up the fact that he had a similar question that you and I had posed in the last episode about the inferi.
I think it might be inferi. I'll have to look it up, but inferi. I think it's inferi.
That would make more sense. I'm just going to keep adding letters to the word.
Inferiorinaries.
I was flipping between this and the Dan Brown books or whatnot. But anyway, he wanted to, you know, he was curious what that was. And it turns out it is essentially zombies. It sounds like that he uses corpses to do his bidding. Which seems like the darkest of dark magic that you could ever dark magic, at least to me.
Yeah, it is absolutely disturbing, the idea of, you know, reanimated corpses. I mean, it's one step more disturbing, honestly, the zombies, it feels like. Because, like you said...
Yeah, because zombies are like... to me, were, you know, they're reincarnated with some sort of primal urge based mm-hmm. on a virus or something, yeah. Right? Where this feels intentional and they're being used as instruments or weapons for something. But yeah, it's very, very unpleasant, and we quickly move off that subject.
It was so funny, though, before we move away from this, is where Dumbledore makes fun of the Daily Prophet, and he's like, I guess it really didn't help all that much because you didn't ask me a personal question. I mean, and my favorite jam is, you know, what my favorite flavor of jam is. And he's like, oh, for, you know, future reference.
For future reference.
Yes. Yeah. that it's raspberry. He's like, you know, again, though, if I were a Death Eater and I had done my research, I would have already known what those jam preferences were, and like the whole thing is just really, really funny.
he doesn't say like, well, those are the stupidest things ever, but he basically goes and mocks them and shows you why they're ridiculous, right? But I love that he does it in a way that's like, right, Harry, we would totally are they would have already done that, you know. He kind of leads Harry along the lines of like, you know why this was stupid, right? It's this, because we both knew that's why it was stupid, right? It was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently his favorite jam is raspberry.
Which, not a bad choice. So,
yeah, he could have done apricot. Ooh. Or something like that, which is just gross. Yeah.
No,
I'm sorry. I just alienated 20 people.
Probably. So. I mean, there are only about 20 that like apricot jam. So,
there's only 20 crazy people out there. I'm not making it any better. No,
so moving on, I love that they get to the house that they're going to, and it looks like it's been attacked. Like the place is, you know, doors are off hinges, windows are blown out, the whole place is blown up, basically. And so they walk into the building, this house, and I love that Dumbledore just pokes a big chair with his wand and out pops Horace Slughorn, which this part of the movie, the part where they, you know, have him pop out and everything, and then they put the house back together, is pretty perfect.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we tend to sort of rip the movies up a little bit here while we're talking about the books, because generally speaking, the books are much better than the movies. But this is one of those moments that I think the movie got so right, was the visual of putting this house back together. It's almost exactly what I envisioned rereading it. It was spot on. And I do love that he's like, what is the blood you used? He's like, dragon's blood. He's like, but it's pretty expensive, so let's hope I can get it back.
Yeah. Well, and I love that Dumbledore's like, I knew that he hadn't really been attacked because there was no dark mark. And I just love the thought of Horace kind of like, you know, face palming, like, oh, I knew I forgot something.
Well, and I love that he elaborates on, you know, it only took him, he only had like 2 minutes to do it because he missed the notification from his intruder charm because he was taking a bath. It's just so ridiculous, the whole thing. And I love that in this part, and I don't think it happens much in the movie, but in this chapter, Dumbledore's really sort of pressing him. Like, who are you hiding from? Who are you afraid of, right? Is it me, or is it me in terms of me forcing you to choose a side? Or are you afraid of Death Eaters? Because if they wanted to find you, they would have found you by now. And, you know, things like that. I just like that he really sort of lays it all out there and then just sort of gets up to use the restroom and walks away.
Yeah, this is something that's really interesting because, you know, one of the things that he doesn't really tell Harry what his plan is, like, as much as he does in the movie, where he just kind of spills it out. And so Harry has to kind of pick up what, you know, Dumbledore is laying down, which one of the things I like about this is that it makes Harry smarter in the book. Like, Harry Right. comes across as somebody who can play Dumbledore's game here. And immediately, you know, Dumbledore is like, oh, and this is Harry Potter. Let me introduce you to this colleague of mine. And immediately we get Horace saying, I see how you think you're going to try and persuade me to come back. And like you said, they have this whole back and forth. And he begins to explain how tired he is. And, you know, he's had this life of going from one place to the next. You know, he only stays at Muggle houses. And those Muggle houses, you know, he only stays there while they're gone, so he has to keep moving. And so, you know, I love that Harry's thinking in his head, like, man, if I would have pictured who had lived here, I would have thought this would have been a fussy old lady's house because of the way that it's decorated. But he's like been moving around, and like you said, Dumbledore kind of presses him on that. Like, why have you been moving so much? Like, what's going on? And he's, you know, very reluctant to say. And he also gives the thing, well, I mean, I don't really want to come back to Hogwarts. I know what happens to your teachers. I mean, what happened to Professor Umbridge? And I love the answer that Dumbledore gives. Well, she ran afoul of some centaurs, which she called filthy half-breeds. And I know that you would have never done that. And Slughorn's just like, well, I never liked her anyway, idiotic woman. And Harry chimes in too, and they kind of both look at each other, and that's the moment where it's like Dumbledore goes, is there a restroom here?
It is. It's so interesting. Slughorn is such a, we kind of get introduced to a new type of, he's like a new type of character that we're introduced to, because so far we've had very dichotic characters, right? Like, there's good and there's bad, right? Like, you're either a supporter of Voldemort or you're not. Right? And here we're sort of introduced to this first character that doesn't want to pick sides, right? Doesn't want to, isn't a Voldemort supporter, but also doesn't really want to speak out against him. Because even if we talk about the ministry and some of those people, they just firmly believed he wasn't back. So they weren't having to make a choice. This is someone faced with sort of the choice of doing what's right or doing what's wrong, who's choosing to do nothing. Right? It's this new sort of category of people we're getting introduced to, and this new approach to it. And it's kind of painted as all of his running is because he doesn't want to make that choice. He doesn't want to have to stop and face that he has to decide one way or the other. And I think that's so interesting. And she's introducing it at an interesting point in the book, right? Because I feel like that theme is going to kind of continue. And you know, just based on what's already happened, you're going to have so many people who have to make a choice one way or the other that you can't really run from it anymore. Or it's getting harder to run from it, as evident by the fact that he has to move like every week. But yeah, it's he kind of lays it out there and calls him on it a little bit. And they, like you said, they have their bonding moment and then he excuses himself. And then this also differs quite a bit from the movie. And I like the subtlety within the book a little bit more and a little more of the restraint that we see in Slughorn in this chapter. And, you know, he says the standard thing everyone says when they meet Harry, and they talk, he talks about how much he looks like his father, but he has his mother's eyes, right? And then we interestingly get into this breakdown of Professor Slughorn's, or Horace, as we call him in this chapter, his thoughts on sort of half-bloods versus pure-bloods. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Like, I think you rightly called out, it's so interesting to get this kind of like morally ambiguous character. And it's not that he's evil in any way, really, but he's just, you can already tell he's opportunistic. And he seems to be kind of obsessed with things like status and fame.
And power. And,
yes.
Yeah. And power, yes. And that's other people's power, not garnering it for himself.
And in many ways, and I love that Harry will later point out in the chapter that when he thinks of Slughorn, he thinks of a giant spider creating this web between all of these famous people that allow him access to things and to certain aspects of power. So he kind of has this behind the throne type of power, like he's the vizier to the king kind of thing, you know, like he doesn't want the power for himself, he just wants access to the power that the other person has. And we see that kind of play out when he starts talking about how much he really liked Lily, and how she was so charming, she was funny, she was very cheeky in her answers in class. And Harry begins to see that he's kind of like this opportunistic collector of people. And he kind of rebuffs at this idea of like that his mother, you know, was a muggle born and how smart she was. And, you know, he's like, well, one of my friends is muggle born and she's the best in our year. And he immediately says, Slughorn does, that he's not prejudiced. But I think he is, because he wouldn't mention it if he didn't think that it was shocking to him that they were so good.
Right. This to me was always that real life manifestation. This is the version of that, of those people who are like, oh, I'm not racist, but the things they do are, the mannerisms and the approach they take are based on very racist behaviors, right? Like, he doesn't think any less of her because she's a muggle born. But at the same time, he's like, oh, well, it's incredulous that they could do that. And it's like, okay, so you're not holding them back, but you're judging them based on that. So that is of itself a form of racism, right? Without it having to be malicious or have a malintent behind it. And it's one of those really interesting ways where it's the same if you were to call someone out in the real world nowadays for a behavior like that. They'd be like, oh, well, I'm not racist, but, you know, or, oh, that it's not because I'm, you know, judgmental or racist or anything. You know, I found it interesting or whatever. It's the same reaction you get here, where it's not racism from a hatred standpoint, but it's its own form of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what it is here is a perpetuation to and a holding on to a stereotype, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not as icky, it's just flat out racism or, you know, sexism or any of those kind of things, but it's still there. And so again, this is kind of a thing where
it's still a perpetuation of an assumption or a belief or a stereotype or a stigma. It's just the thought process, but it's the continuation or the buy-in into it, right? The belief that that is real.
I think, too, what is fascinating is that one of the things that we also see again here with Slughorn is that one of the things he says to Harry is that, I don't want to come to Hogwarts, because that's tantamount to declaring allegiance for the Order of the Phoenix. And I don't want to join the Order of the Phoenix. And I love that Harry just immediately just dives into this almost soliloquy about what it means to be a teacher at Hogwarts and how, oh, well, you know that most of the teachers there aren't actually, you know, members of the Order of the Phoenix. And I mean, it's really the safest place to be. I mean, no teachers have died except, well, I mean, for Quirrell, and he was, you know, in league with Voldemort. And so, you know, I mean, I reckon that nobody is safer than anybody who is at Hogwarts because, well, Dumbledore's there. And isn't he the one that Voldemort always feared? And he's playing through, like, Harry has really picked up the ways to get this guy to do what Dumbledore wants him to do. And so I just think that it's just so smart. And I love that here again, the book really allows Harry to kind of show off his mental abilities and his mental cunning in some ways, because this is the game that him and Dumbledore are playing to try and lure Slughorn back to Hogwarts. And it's great. Like, Harry's really on top of his game here. Like, Hermione, I think, would be proud.
Well, and I think it also plays into what we're going to see in the relationship between Harry and Slughorn through the rest of this book, too. The movie, if you've seen the movie, I think taking this part out doesn't serve him any justice as to how he's going to continue to build this relationship with Slughorn. So I think it helps those interactions make more sense, which will make more sense when we get to them. But it feels more like the continuation of a relationship that he's already established versus having to start from scratch. So it is really interesting how he's able to sort of easily manipulate him. And I love that when Dumbledore comes back, they start talking about, are you okay? Are you having some tummy issues, essentially? and then I love that Dumbledore retorts about, no, you just know how much I love those knitting magazines.
That was really funny. And that is a part that they do well in the movie, too. And I love that, you know, he says to Harry, oh, I guess it's time to go. I mean, I can tell that there's just no chance of getting you back. And, you know, this is the moment where Slughorn's like, all right, I'll do it. I'll come out of retirement. And then he demands, you know, a bigger office and more pay. So as they're walking away, again, we kind of get this quiet moment of Dumbledore and Harry having a conversation about Slughorn. And I love that he asked, well, what did you think of him? Did you like him? And Harry's like,
I wish you all could see Matt's face right now.
But I thought it was really interesting because Dumbledore does not make him answer the question. He just kind of explains Horace a little bit and the fact that, you know, he likes his creature comforts. He likes his famous people. This is the moment where, you know, Harry begins to get this picture in his mind of a spider kind of weaving his web. And that, I'll tell you this, Dumbledore says to Harry, that I think you want to be on your guard with him this year because he is probably going to try and collect you like he has others, because you would be the crown jewel of his collection because you are the chosen one. You are the boy who lived. And this makes Harry feel uncomfortable. And this is also, I think, a key moment where he doesn't just quite spell out what he wants of Harry this year. And I think it's smarter to allow the mystery here, especially in the book, to play out a little bit more, which is great. I mean, I'm really glad that she does it this way, because I think what we want in the book here is to be able to sit a little bit more with our discomfort about this new character.
I mean, just everything we've learned, we don't know his intentions, we don't know what he'd do, we don't know how to trust him. And, you know, just like with all of our other knowledge of characters who are opportunistic in other movies and books and things, you know, you just don't really trust them. And you feel like, and I think that the way that she phrased it and the way Dumbledore says it to Harry about you need to keep your guard up is perfect, because it's not that you should, you know, not spend time with them. It's not that they're not valuable. It's not that they're not good people. It's just you have to be very careful mm-hmm. with them. And I love that how he phrases that. I also love that he does not do the thing he does in the movie, where here he says, you know, you keep your guard up. He will likely try to collect you. And in the movie, you know, he says something like, do you want me to let him? And that's not here. And I think that goes back to what you were saying. It allows you to sit with it a little bit more and think about it, versus having all of that fast forward and being told how to feel about that. You just get to kind of figure that out for yourself.
This is too really interesting because they finish that conversation, they travel to the borough, and he asks him, he says, I want to have a couple more words with you, basically, and so let's go into this shed. And so they go into this shed, and I love that Dumbledore here says, you know, I hate to mention the name Sirius, because I know how it makes you feel, but I want to say how I think he would be so proud of you with the way that you're handling everything. And Dumbledore does such a great job, too, of letting him know that, Harry, I know what you're feeling and how cruel it is that you didn't have enough time together. And I just love that, you know, Harry starts to get a little bit of teary-eyed, you know, and he's like, it's just hard because I know he's not going to write me again. And that, you know, he doesn't want to admit, you know, necessarily to Dumbledore that he spent a lot of time in the summer not really wanting to talk to anybody, but he came to the realization that he didn't want to be somebody who was all cracked up and couldn't do what he needed to, and that he didn't want to be that person who just basically ran away from his problems. And I just think there's a real beauty in that, because we talked a lot in the last book about how Harry had depression, you know, and coming out of depression doesn't mean not talking about it, and it doesn't mean not acknowledging that it exists and that there's still pieces of it there with you as you're coming out of it, but it's about being honest, and Harry's really honest here, and I really appreciated that, because it's not an easy thing to come out of, and especially on top of all of that depression that he went through, then he was dealing with the loss of the last person that was family, in the sense of, like, he was his godfather, right? This was the last piece of family that he had left, and now that person is gone too. And so it's a really strong moment here. And it really, I think she immediately took the relationship that was so awkward at the beginning for Harry and created a space where now I think Harry and Dumbledore have bonded in a moment that will allow the rest of the relationship to flourish throughout the rest of this book. Like, he, in this one scene, she made them closer than they have been all five books already.
To your point on depression, I think the other part of that you kind of touched on is, but like, coming out of depression doesn't mean that it's fixed and it went away and just magically everything's better. Like, you don't have to be happy. You don't have to be, you know, all of a sudden, oh, everything's okay. Everything's great again, guys. It's all fixed. Yay. Right. He just is taking the steps to cope and deal with it. And it absolutely create a beautiful moment between them. And I also think that closeness that we build here is continued with, you know, Dumbledore mentioning that he wants to have private lessons with Harry this coming year. Right. And that, you know, he wants to tutor him in something, because we've spent the last two or three books with Dumbledore essentially ignoring Harry out of fear that it's going to cause them all vulnerability, to the kind of the opposite, where he's now leaning into the relationship and is like, I feel like you and I need to be closer. We need to really trust one another to do the right thing so that we can all win in the end. And I feel like he's kind of done a 180 on that. And this is him trying to show that to Harry, right? Not just tell him like, oh, I did the wrong thing. It's him really taking the steps to show him he's learning from this mistake and he wants to try this a different way. And acknowledging that you know, even if you put the last chapter and this chapter together, that Harry's had a tough life of it. And that, you know, this is Dumbledore leaning into him truly caring about Harry. So I think it's just a beautiful relationship that's developing in general. And it's lovely. And it's also done with such a nice little dash of humor, because Dumbledore keeps referring to the cabinet full of spiders and how he'd tip his hat to him, but he'd, you know, be fearful that he'd get a bunch of spiders on him. And they just kind of use, he kind of tries to like keep it intimate, but not heavy. It's still kind of a light conversation.
Well, I love too that they have the conversation then about the prophecy and if Harry's told anybody, and the fact that he says, he compliments Harry. Yeah, I think you've done such a wise thing not telling anybody, but I do think that you could relax that a little bit when it comes to, you know, Mr. Weasley and Mrs. Granger. It's important for you to not do them the disservice by not confiding in them. And he says something really important, how you're going to need your friends. And you so rightly said that Sirius wouldn't want you to shut yourself away. And so I think this is a really important moment too, again, connecting to the idea of coming out of depression. Like, you need those core people in your life and you need to make them a part of your life and not to you know, push them away. And I think that's a really great moment. So we get the thought process here then that Harry will confide in them in this book about what's coming up. And then lastly, he says that he wants to take a more active hand in Harry's education. And he is going to be giving him private lessons throughout the rest of this year, which is fantastic. And Harry is like, oh, that's great. So I won't have to be doing Aquamancy anymore. And he's like, no. And then my favorite part is Harry being like, good, because those were... and then Dumbledore's like, I think the word fiasco would be a good word here.
Yeah, I loved that. I love when he kind of, it's his way of admitting too that things didn't work, right? And I love how he does that, and then he ends on kind of one last piece and says, you know, I'm having you come to the Burrow, and because of that, the security here is going to be incredibly tight. And, you know, the Weasleys have already had to be subjected to things like their mail is being searched and things like that, right? And he doesn't tell Harry this to make him feel bad, but he says, but the greatest disservice you could do to their sacrifice is to do something very brazen, essentially, right? Like, don't go and play hero. Like, how you're going to do this is you're going to sit tight, you're going to let them protect you. That's the best thing you can do for everybody in the circumstance. And it's just like this little tidbit of advice, like, hey, you trust me now? We're on the same page. All right, you know, sit tight. Just let them be, let everyone do their job. Don't run off, right? And it's kind of that little piece that he just needs to kind of tell Harry, like, don't do it. You're going to want to, but don't do it, man, which I think is interesting.
And I think what I love about that is that he appeals to his respect for the Weasleys, right? And Harry, very quickly, he says, I understand. You know, I get what you're laying down, Dumbledore. It makes complete sense. You're absolutely right. And, you know, I think Harry, when we look back, we can see how overjoyed the fact that this is going to happen in the first place. So I don't think he wants to do anything to mess that up. I also think this warning here is what makes the beginning of the movie completely ridiculous and make no sense story-wise.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah, it makes the first part of this movie so different from the first part of this book. And the book seems to fit all of the characters so much better. It feels more authentic to who they are and what we've come to know of them. And so it's been a really interesting first few chapters, very different from the last few books that we've had and how we sort of get into the story. We spent a lot of time not at Hogwarts, a lot of time not in the wizarding world, if you will. And even this chapter and the previous one, while with Dumbledore, they're not terribly in the magical world, right? We were still at a Muggle home. We just got to the Burrow. We haven't even actually set foot in the Burrow yet. So it's such a different way to start. And I think it really does set the tone for what we're going to expect from the rest of the book and the rest of the series.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, especially since the next chapter is called An Excess of Phlegm, so that should be enjoyable. But before we get there, Drea, you know, where can people find you if they do want to catch up with you online?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's C-O-F-F-M-A-N.
And you can find me here on the network doing a show called Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. It's all about Star Wars each and every week, so make sure you check that out. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero under the name MattRushing02. I'm also on the Trek FM network doing two shows. One is called The Orb with Chris Jones, where we talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine when we get a chance to discuss things together. And then you can find me doing the 602 Club, which is the General Geek Show. We talk about all of the fandoms we love, which it's been pretty fun recently. We've been talking about the Zombieland films, so that's been enjoyable. And then last but not least, you can find me doing Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney, where we talk about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your Outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.